So welcome everyone to our Tattva Sandarbha course. This is a very interesting book written by His Divine Grace Jiva Goswami Prabhupada. And we are going to cover the whole book over the period of the next 4 weeks. 63 verses in 20 days. And we'll be going through the text and discussing verse by verse. Hopefully you've all got a copy of the book. If you don't have, you can get it from the VIHG office. We're going to try and make this... is actually not such an easy book, really. It's very philosophical, very analytical, and very shastric. Yeah, even going into different word meanings and things like that. So it isn't so easy, that's a fact, but we will try our best to make it, you know, user-friendly, audience-friendly, devotee-friendly, like that. And try and keep it a little simple, because it can get complicated if we want it to. So, in order to be tuned in for the class each day, we do seriously recommend, please, that you try and read over whatever we're going to be going through the following day. And tomorrow, we are going to go through what, if you open up your overview book, right, just to the very first page, the table, the beginning of the table of contents, then you'll see that there are three preliminary little pieces, and then there's section one, the Mangalacharana, which begins on page six. So the idea, we'll see how it goes today, but the idea at this point is that tomorrow we are going to read through all of these eight verses and see if we can discuss them tomorrow completely. Perhaps we'll have to carry on Wednesday, but we'll see how it goes. We'll try and get through the Mangalacharana tomorrow. So in other words, we would appreciate it if you could please read through those eight verses between... in the meantime, before tomorrow. Is that okay? Try your best. They're pretty easy. They're the easiest verses in the book, so, you know, it's not a big thing. So you do that, and then you'll be ready for tomorrow. Let's see. So now, let us just introduce Tattva Sandarbha. Tattva Sandarbha is written by Srila Jiva Goswami. So let us first of all try to introduce Srila Jiva Goswami. Of course, we've all heard of Srila Jiva Goswami. He is one of the six Goswamis and very important devotee, very, very important devotee. Srila Prabhupada explains, that he, all of the six Goswamis made particular contributions. Each one had like their specialty, so to speak. And Jiva Goswami, his specialty was philosophy, philosophical definitions. So he wrote quite a bit. We'll have a look at the... There's one page here written by... It's from a purport by Srila Prabhupada. Mentions all his books. We'll go through that shortly. But he's particularly prominent for that philosophy, analyzing the philosophy, clarifying our Gaudiya Vaishnav philosophy. And he did that in 25 books. And the Shat Sandarbhas, six Sandarbhas, are six of those 25. So Jiva Goswami, he is the son of Anupam or Vallabha, who was the youngest brother in the family of Rupa and Sanatan. Sanatan, of course, is the oldest brother. Rupa is in the middle. Anupam, or Vallabha, he's the youngest brother. He's mentioned a little bit in Chaitanya Charitamrita. He was a very great devotee. Very great devotee, particularly of Lord Ram, actually. And he was a married man, Jiva's his son, but then he left home when Jiva was young. He left, took sannyas, went on pilgrimage, and passed away. They say he passed away in Pandharpur, which is in Maharashtra, famous place of pilgrimage. He passed away there. And that is mentioned also in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Rupa and Sanatan, they discuss their brother a bit. So, Srila Jiva Goswami, he was born, the family's place of residence is Ramakeli. So he was born there and brought up there, and first of all his father and his uncles, they all took sannyas, they all left. You know the story with Rupa and Sanatan, they were government ministers, but they managed to escape that, and his father left home. So there are these three very prominent personalities in his life. They all leave home when Jiva is young, just a young fellow. And, well, his childhood is interesting. There's a very nice description, brief, but very nice description in Bhakti Ratnakara. There, Narahari Chakravarti talks a little bit about the childhood of Jiva Goswami. And Jiva Goswami, he was a very special person, even from his very, very early days. Of course, it's not surprising because we know that Jiva Goswami, he is Vilas Manjari. He is one of the main Manjari associates of Radha and Krishna. And the other Goswamis, they're all Manjaris in Krishna Leela. So he is definitely Nitya Siddha, to say the least, one of the most intimate associates of Radha and Krishna in Goloka Vrindavan, and of course of Lord Chaitanya in his Navadvip, eternal Navadvip Leela. So he showed that as a child, Jiva Goswami, as a little boy. Something similar to Prahlad, in fact, basically the same thing. As with Prahlad, that's described in Srimad Bhagavatam a little. And Uddhava and Maharaj Parikshit, his childhood is described. How, as a little boy, he didn't really want to play with his friends. Just, you know, the childish play of children. He wanted to do Krishna conscious things. So Jiva Goswami was exactly the same as a child. He didn't want to just go out and play around and run around as children do usually. He was fully absorbed in Krishna consciousness. And it's described in Bhakti Ratnakara, it's described very nicely how as a little boy, you know, some little boys have teddy bears. Little girls have dolls. He made deities of Krishna and Balaram. He made them himself. And he would spend the whole day dressing them, putting chandan, sandalwood paste on them, making garlands, different garlands, putting on different garlands, different types of the day, changing the clothes at different times of the day, ornamenting the deities in different ways. His play was sort of orchestrating pastimes and interactions between Krishna and Balaram. He would arrange, you know, different settings for them with, you know, different like backdrops or whatever. And he would have them playing games as cowherd boys. This is how he'd spend his whole day, usually. And Bhakti Ratnakara says that he would take food different types of the day. He really enjoyed making food offerings. Then he'd distribute the prasadam to his friends. And when he'd offer his obeisances, then he would cry tears of ecstasy. This is just as a child, like preschool child. And when he would go to bed, he would take them to bed. He would clasp them to his chest in a firm and fond embrace and take them to bed and sleep there with his deities. So like this, he couldn't be separated from these deities, from Krishna and Balaram. So he was a very great devotee, and there's a very nice description of how, you know, as we mentioned, his two uncles left, then his own father left, and all because they're great devotees, and they were always great devotees. You know, Rupa Goswami, he wrote many books. There's one book called Hansaduta. Some of you may have heard of that or perhaps read that. That's a very nice book where Lalita is lamenting Krishna's having left Vrindavan. So Rupa Goswami, he wrote that book in which Lalita is appealing to a swan, Hansa, to carry a message to Krishna. So Hansaduta, the swan carrier. So that book was written before Rupa Goswami left home. It was written while he was still there as a minister or something in the government, and still very closely associated with Jiva as one of his uncles. So they're very, very great devotees all from the outset. And even before, like Rupa and Sanatan, even before they became prominent as the leaders of the six Goswamis, they're already great, great, very great devotees. And Jiva saw that. So there's a nice description in Bhakti Ratnakara of how when Rupa and Sanatan left home, and Jiva's father also left home, how Jiva was feeling great separation from his uncles and his father, and how all the other people there in the town, they're all saying, he's going to leave also. Just wait and see. He's going to leave home. Yeah, so he did. According to Bhakti Ratnakara, he had a dream. Lord Chaitanya, actually Lord Chaitanya had already left the planet by that time, but Lord Chaitanya appeared to him in a dream, and Lord Nityananda. And in that dream, Lord Chaitanya ordered Jiva to leave home and join Rupa and Sanatan in Vrindavan. And he told him, I'm giving you this place, Vrindavan, as your family place now. So you're a family member, you have to go there. And then Lord Chaitanya told Lord Nityananda that now I'm handing this boy over to you. And Lord Nityananda accepted Jiva. So the next day, apparently, Jiva left home, went to Navadvip. Lord Nityananda was there. That is described in Navadvip Dham Mahatmya. You may have read that by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. It explains how Lord Nityananda took Srila Jiva Goswami on the Navadvip Mandal Parikrama. Very nice description. And when we do the Navadvip Mandal Parikrama, we follow the same course. We stop, you know, we visit the same places in the same order. as Lord Nityananda took Jiva Goswami that time. So then Lord Nityananda told Jiva that you have to go now. Go and join your uncles. And here actually we could refer to page 4, because Prabhupada here in this excerpt from this purport from Chaitanya Charitamrita Adi Leela chapter 10 verse 85, from that purport, Srila Prabhupada here gives a very brief summary of the life of Jiva Goswami, mainly from this point actually. Mainly from this point of his going to Navadvip and being taken around by Lord Nityananda. Then he was sent off, as we said, and he stopped in Benares. He stopped in Benares, Varanasi, and there he was schooled by Madhusudana Vachaspati, who was a very great devotee. Not only a devotee, but he was a great, great intellectual. So Jiva Goswami spent some time there in Benares and studying all the scriptures very rigorously and studying Sanskrit very rigorously. So he became big, big authority. Yeah. Under the guidance of Madhusudana Vachaspati. So then he went to Vrindavan and Rupa and Sanatan were there and he took shelter of them and he has become famous as one of those six Goswamis. As we said, he edited, Prabhupada says, at least 25 books. They're all very much celebrated. Hari Nam Amrita Vyakaran, that's his Sanskrit grammar, all based on the holy names of Krishna. It's a very nice Sanskrit grammar. Of course, Sanskrit grammar, I don't know how familiar any of you are with it. You know, it's hard to make Sanskrit grammar easy. But Jiva Goswami made it kind of like fun for the devotees by adopting all different Krishna conscious types, like expressions for the different rules. My favorite, I sort of glanced through part of it some years ago, my favorite is that in Sanskrit, there is a whole system of how words meet each other. The end of one word meets the beginning of the next word. And then, for the sake of syntax, the flow of the sound, for the sake of syntax, then either the end of the first word changes, or the beginning of the second word, or both change. This is called sandhi. Sandhi means meeting. Yeah, when words meet. So they change like that, and there are loads of rules, sandhi rules. There's just tons of them. You know, if a word ends with an A, but the first letter of the next word is E, then something happens. So for all the letters, it's like that. Lots of rules. However, the one, as I said, the one I particularly like is for when the last letter of the first word is a consonant, and the first letter of the second word is also a consonant. The consonants are called Vishnu Janas as a group. He doesn't call them consonants, he calls them Vishnu Janas, which means they're the people of Lord Vishnu, they're devotees. So the consonants are devotees, the vowels, they're called, what are they called? Sarveshwaras, big controllers. Yeah. So anyway, when the last letter of the first word is a consonant and the first word of the first letter of the second word, then that type of sandhi, you've got two Vishnu Janas meeting. So that type of sandhya, the type of change which occurs, the rule is called Sadhu Sangha. Because when Vishnu Janas meet, of course, what would you get? You just get Krishna Katha. So like this, he makes it nicer. I must say, it's not easy. That's really not easy. If we were having a course on that. Anyway, so that was one of his important books, Sutra Malika, Dhatu Sangraha, Krishnarcha Dipika, Gopal Virudavali, that's very nice. Different prayers and appeals to Krishna, to Gopal, very beautiful. Rasamrita Shesha, Madhava Mahotsava, Sankalpa Kalpa Vriksha, that's also a very nice book, beautiful book, discussing Krishna leaving Vrindavan. Well, there are two parts actually. The first part, it's probably a couple of hundred verses or so, discusses Krishna leaving Vrindavan. Did he? Or actually, particularly, did he come back or not? And he debates with himself about that. Very, very nice. And you'll be happy to know he concludes that Krishna definitely did come back. Yes. Because he promised to. And he would never break his promise. And Uddhava promised that he would. And he would definitely never break the word of a devotee. So he had to come back. He must have come back. That's a very nice book. Bhavarta Suchaka Champu. Gopal Tapani Tika. That is a commentary on Gopal Tapani Upanishad. It's a very important Vaishnav Upanishad. It's one of the 108. And it's, you know, like the most Krishna conscious, basically. Or you could say, obviously Krishna conscious of all the Upanishads. So he wrote a commentary on that. And, oh, then he wrote a commentary on Brahma Samhita. That's also very nice. Very nice commentary. A commentary on Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Then a commentary on Ujjvala Nilamani, which is like the postgraduate study of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. It's written also by Rupa Goswami. So Jiva Goswami wrote a commentary on that. A commentary on the Yogasara Stava. A commentary on the Gayatri Mantra, as described in the Agni Purana. Yeah. Well, we're going to be referring to that. And he wrote also extensively about, at least about the Brahma Gayatri, the first Gayatri Mantra, which we chant, those of us who are second initiated. He wrote some explanation on that in Paramatma Sandarbha, and we're going to go through that also. It's very interesting. Then a description of the Lord's lotus feet and the lotus feet of Radharani. Gopal Champu. This is about 3,000 verses, I think. Anyway, it's pretty big. And very beautiful descriptions of Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan. Then, finally, Srila Prabhupada says, 7 Sandarbhas. Krama, Tattva, Bhagavat, Paramatma, Krishna, Bhakti, and Preeti Sandarbhas. Well, actually, the Krama Sandarbha is his commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam. It's not that there are 7 Sandarbhas, there are 6 Sandarbhas, but his commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam, that means his verse-by-verse commentary. Just like Prabhupada did verse-by-verse commentary, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and various others. Jiva Goswami, he did commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam. That's called Krama Sandarbha. And then there's the 6 Sandarbhas, beginning with Tattva Sandarbha, which is what we're going to be discussing. So then after the disappearance of Rupa and Sanatan, Jiva Goswami became the Acharya. He became the head of the Sampradaya. At least he became the head, particularly in Vrindavan. Well, Prabhupada says he became the Acharya of all the Vaishnavas in Bengal, Orissa, and the rest of the world. Mother Janava was still living, you know. Anyway, he definitely, in due course of time, became the actual head in due course of time, and he would guide everyone. He established the Radha Damodar temple, and Prabhupada lived there from 62 till 65. And he associated with Krishnadas Kaviraj. They were very close. They were very close. And another very important contribution he made, he directed Srinivas Naratam and Shamananda. Dukhi Krishnadas is Shamananda Pandit. He directed them to take some of the writings of the six Goswamis, means the actual original handwritten texts, to Bengal and Orissa to distribute amongst the devotees. Nowadays, of course, you know, we have books, Prabhupada's books, and even like Nectar of Devotion, it's one of Rupa Goswami's books. We have these things by the thousand, tens of thousands, hundreds, millions even. You know, if you want a Nectar of Devotion, you just, you know, probably, you know, all your friends have them, or you can just buy one from the temple bookshop in any temple around the world. It'll take a matter of a few minutes. In those days, if you wanted a copy of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, you had to put your order in. Well, first of all, if you weren't living in Vrindavan, you just wouldn't get it anyway, until these three devotees went to Bengal and Orissa. The devotees out there, they'd only heard about these things. And devotees would come and say that, you know, come from Vrindavan and say that I was with Rupa Goswami. He was reading from Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, and it said this. You know, all the things, we just open the book and just read it, and it's all there. But they would bring these little snippets. Rupa Goswami wrote this, Sanatan wrote that. And they would go back and tell the devotees. So then Jiva sent Srinivas Naratam and Shamananda back with one original copy, and the only original copy in many cases of many of those important books. Unfortunately, on the way, they were robbed. The books were stolen. And everyone thought, you know, these are the original, and in some cases, only copies of certain of these books. So everyone thought, of course, this is a big disaster, but it's a bit of a long story. We won't go into it now, but eventually Srinivas, he located those books and got them back. So then, you know, if you wanted a copy of Nectar of Devotion, you had to put your order in and come back in a couple of years. Maybe. You know, because there's probably a queue. So maybe you come back in 20 years, you can get your copy of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Yeah. So that was a very important mission that he sent those three devotees on. And let's see. Well, when Janava came, Prabhupada, I'm just taking a few points from this purport here. When Mother Janava came, then she came to Jiva, and Jiva organized everything for her, and she was shown around Vrindavan. And on the whole, he looked after all the devotees. So, Jiva Goswami, very, very important devotee. He wrote 400,000 verses. Rupa wrote 100,000. Jiva wrote 400,000. Srimad Bhagavatam is 18,000. So, of course, it's got purports also. But as we go through Tattva Sandarbha, you will see that some of these verses, they're not just your ordinary run-of-the-mill verse, four lines, you know, something quite brief. But many of these 400,000 verses, like all these six sandarbhas, they're not written in poetry, they're written in prose. And some of these verses are long. So he wrote a lot. He really, really wrote a lot. So that's something about a lot. He really, really wrote a lot. So that's something about Jiva Goswami. Now, let us just mention a little bit about the six Sandarbhas. I think actually what we can do here is we can read a little bit from the next page, page 5, the introduction to the overview. So Srila Prabhupada comments in one lecture. Jiva Goswami has got six Sandarbhas, theses. Bhagavat Sandarbha, Krishna Sandarbha, Tattva Sandarbha, Preeti Sandarbha, like that. So these books are, I don't think it is published in English. So these Sandarbhas are so philosophically discussed that throughout the whole world, there is not a single philosopher who can defy these Jiva Goswami's six Sandarbhas. These are very important books. Very important books. Then, six Goswamis of Vrindavan made particularly important contributions to the mission of Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. They renounced the comforts of material life and absorbed themselves in the service of Radha and Krishna. They recorded in written form the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. They uncovered the lost places of Lord Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan. And they established the proper practices of devotional service. Srinivas Acharya sings, they're very expert in scrutinizingly studying all the revealed scriptures with the aim of establishing eternal religious principles for the benefit of all human beings. Thus they're honored all over the three worlds and they're worth taking shelter of. That's from his song about the six Goswamis. I'm sure you're familiar with that. So then, Srila Jiva Goswami's main service was to establish the philosophical basis of Lord Chaitanya's movement. And among his writings, his six Sandarbhas, or essays, this word Sandarbha basically translates, arguably, as essay. Yeah. So, among his writings, the six Sandarbhas are very important. Tattva Sandarbha is the first of these six. Then just have a look down in the last paragraph there. We just mentioned a little bit about the others. So there's Tattva Sandarbha. Then next is Paramatma Sandarbha. That is the second one. It describes Atma and Paramatma. Then there's Bhagavat Sandarbha, which establishes that the Bhagavan feature of the Absolute Truth is the highest. There's Brahmeti, Paramatmeti, Bhagavan iti Shabjate. So of the three features, then the Bhagavan feature is the highest. Then Krishna Sandarbha establishes that Lord Krishna is the supreme aspect of the Bhagavan feature. Or actually even, you know, a better way to put it perhaps would be that he is like the origin of the Bhagavan feature and the original form of. It's not like you have this Bhagavan feature and he is, you know, one of many displays of it. He is the original Bhagavan. Krishna Stu Bhagavan Swayam. Then Bhakti Sandarbha explains Bhakti, the process for approaching Krishna. And Preeti Sandarbha explains love of God. So what does Tattva Sandarbha describe? Well, let us see. It's all here in this little introduction. Well, we can read the kind of middle paragraph, fourth paragraph. Tattva Sandarbha can be considered logically divided into two parts, although Srila Jiva Goswami did not specifically indicate this division. The first 26 texts prove the authority of Srimad Bhagavatam on the basis of reason and various scriptural authorities. This having been done, the Bhagavatam itself becomes the prime source of verification and continues to be so throughout the rest of the six sandarbhas. The second part of the Tattva Sandarbha, beginning from text 27, ascertains the general nature of the supreme truth or tattva as revealed in Srimad Bhagavatam. Pandits sometimes call the two parts of Tattva Sandarbha the Praman Kanda and Prameya Kanda. Praman means source of valid knowledge, and Prameya means the object of Praman. In other words, the knowledge that you get from the source. So in other words, the two parts deal with epistemology and ontology, respectively. I'm sure those two words being there has made it a lot clearer to you. Right? It did. I had to look them up in the dictionary. Epistemology means, it's a term which means like the process of acquiring knowledge, basically, or no, it, not exactly that. It means that you investigate where to get knowledge from. You get the idea. Epistemology means you figure out where are you going to get your knowledge from. Because there are many alternatives. Here, of course, the idea is we want to ascertain what is the absolute truth. So, you know, to ascertain what is the absolute truth, you've got all sorts of possible sources. Different religions with their different scriptures. In the Vedic scriptures, they're all different Vedic scriptures. Then, you know, you get philosophers like the Western philosophers. You can just speculate yourself if you want to. There are many potential sources. So epistemology means that process for figuring out where you're going to get your knowledge from. Figuring out what is your process for acquiring knowledge, what it's going to be. So in other words, this first 26 texts, well of course the first 8, they're the Mangalacharna, but anyway, basically the first half or thereabouts of Tattva Sandarbha is dedicated to figuring out and establishing what we are going to use for developing, for getting our knowledge of the Absolute Truth. And then the second half, the ontology part. Ontology kind of translates into layman's English to mean something like the process of studying existence, being. The process for figuring out what is reality. In other words, very broad type of philosophical subject. What is the nature of existence? What is the nature of being? What's it all about in practically the broadest sense? Now, what we'll do now is we will do a quick overview of the overview, just to show you how Jiva Goswami does this, and then I think it'll make this all a little clearer to you. Let's turn back to the table of contents. So there we have section 1 is the Mangalacharana. Mangalacharana is basically a process of, there are three main parts. We're going to talk about it tomorrow in more detail. But generally, in fact, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami in Chaitanya Charitamrita, he defines what is a Mangalacharana. There are three parts, he says. You define the objective or the subject. of your book, what you're going to be talking about. Then you offer benedictions to the readers. Jiva Goswami in text, I think it's 4 or 5 or something like that. No, what is it? It's number 6. Gives very interesting benediction. We'll talk about that one tomorrow. Don't worry about it too much. So first of all, defining the objectives or defining the subject, then offering benedictions, then offering obeisances to the higher authorities. Benedictions are offered to the readers. Obeisances and prayers are offered to the seniors. So they're essentially 3 parts, 3 aspects, really, you could say, to the Mangalacharna. Anyway, we'll go through that tomorrow. Then section 2 and 3, these are the main things we're going to be going over this week and next week. So this is going up to verse 26, as you can see. Section 3 concludes with verse 26. So these 2 sections then, they are the Praman section. They are that section in which Jiva Goswami is deciding that if we want to understand the absolute truth, that is our ultimate goal, to really know the absolute truth, to be completely clear. This is what the 6 sandarbhas are all about. We want to be completely clear in every respect as far as is possible. What is the absolute truth? How to approach the absolute truth? Different features of, different aspects of the absolute truth, like this. So if we want to understand the absolute truth in that very deep way, then where will we get our information from? This is the subject of section 2 and section 3. Where are we going to get our information from? And he discusses a number of possibilities. You'll see we've divided each section into a number of subsections. First, even though it's not specifically mentioned here in the table of contents, but you'll see it when we begin verse 9. First of all, he says that we are not good sources of knowledge, because we are conditioned souls. We have the 4 defects. So then he decides, he mentions 10, traditionally there are 10 possible sources of knowledge traditionally in India, or traditionally according to the Vedas, you know, like Shabda, and then there's inference. We're going to talk about all 10 of them when we get there. One of them, though, one is Shabda, spiritual sound. There are different types of Shabda, different types, well, actually in a broader sense, Shabda can just mean like scriptural knowledge. But he concludes that Apurusheya Shabda is the best. That knowledge, that scriptural knowledge, which is Apurusheya, it has not come from humans. It has come from beyond humans. That is the best. And where do you find that? You find it in the Vedas. So therefore, if you look in table of contents, section 2a, he very quickly comes to the point that the Vedic literatures are the best evidence. But then there are many Vedic literatures. A complication arises here, which we will be addressing. You may not even be aware that this complication exists, but it does, and he addresses it at length. That is, that amongst people who study the Vedas, they don't all see the Vedic scriptures, you know, including Bhagavad Gita and the Bhagavatam and the Puranas and everything. Not everyone who follows the Vedic tradition sees the Vedic scriptures as we do. There is a fairly large school of thought who think that only the four Vedas are Vedic. Everything else, well, they don't take it so seriously. So in the second part, part B of section 2, Jiva Goswami establishes that the Puranas are Vedic. Then he goes on in section C, that not only are they Vedic, but because they're compiled by Vyas, because Vyas is a very special person, then the Puranas are actually specially important, even amongst the Vedas. Then section D, using various evidences, scriptural evidences, he comes to the point of establishing that not only are the Puranas especially important, but they're actually the most important part of all the Vedic scriptures. They're more important than the four Vedas or the Upanishads. Actually, not just the Puranas and Itihasas. Itihasas means basically Mahabharata and Ramayana. Means mainly those two literatures. So the Puranas and Itihasas are the most are more important than any other of the Vedic literatures, and particularly the Puranas. But of course there are 18 Puranas, then there's 18 Upapuranas. There's another 18 Alpa Puranas. If you really get down to it, there are 54 Puranas. And, you know, some of them, they're in different modes. Some are for people who are in ignorance. They promote Lord Shiva. Shiva Stu Bhagavan Swayam. What do you think of that? We don't want to confuse anyone. But in some of those scriptures, you find that statement. In the Rajasic Puranas, then Lord Brahma is promoted. Brahma Stu Bhagavan Swayam. So these different deities are promoted. So if it's a matter of the Puranas, then of all the Puranas as a body, you're going to end up confused. So in 2E, he makes the point that there is actually a hierarchy amongst the Puranas. In terms of the modes, the mode of goodness is the highest, of course. And of the Puranas in the mode of goodness, Srimad Bhagavatam is the best. And then finally he establishes that Srimad Bhagavatam is definitely the best source of knowledge about the Absolute Truth. So we will be using Srimad Bhagavatam as our source of reference. Section 3 is more or less corollary, just kind of backing that up. 3A, authoritative descriptions of Srimad Bhagavatam. Again, we don't want to confuse any of you, but there is even a debate about which book is Srimad Bhagavatam. So he identifies in terms of the contents as referred to in other scriptures, he confirms that Srimad Bhagavatam, as we know it, is Srimad Bhagavatam. Then there's glorification. The Garuda Purana glorifies the Bhagavatam. Various commentators, Ramanuja, Madhva, and others, they also confirm Srimad Bhagavatam is that topmost scripture. Srimad Bhagavatam confirms it's the topmost scripture. Then the speaker of Srimad Bhagavatam, Shukadev, he is the topmost of all speakers of all different scriptures. So he confirms the fact that it's his realization. That's also a confirmation of the superiority of Srimad Bhagavatam. And then there's a few other quotes also confirming that. And therefore we end up at the end of text 26, hopefully being completely convinced that Srimad Bhagavatam is the supremely authoritative source of knowledge about the absolute truth. And then, we won't go into it now, but in the third week, second half of our course, when we'll go into the last three sections, then he defines the absolute truth in terms of how Srimad Bhagavatam explains the absolute truth. So this is basically what we're going to be studying. As we said, it is quite philosophical, and therefore, you know, it requires some concentration. I've been in other courses where other devotees have taught this, and I've seen that some of the audience sort of struggled with it, but we'll try and make it as easy to follow as possible. Starting with tomorrow, discussing the Mangala Charana, so if you could please read that, it's very simple. 8 short verses. Any comments or questions?
Sorry?
The word for word. The problem is, you know, if we'd put in the word for word, the book would have got one third bigger. Yeah. So we're kind of... it's available from Gopi Puranadana Prabhu. He did these translations. I don't have it myself. Okay, so we'll see you tomorrow. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Vasudevaya. Here is the attendance sheet. Could you sign yourselves present as you did yesterday, please? So today we are going into the text of Tattvasandarbha, beginning with section 1, the Mangala Charana, which is from text 1 to text 8. Of course, there is a little invocation there also, right at the top of page 6, which is given by Srila Jiva Goswami and is not really considered part of the invocation. Sri Krishna Jayati, may Lord Krishna be glorified. So then, from verse 1 to verse 8, this is the Mangala Charana. Mangala Charana basically means enacting auspiciousness, creating, establishing auspiciousness. Mangala means auspicious, like Mangal Arati. Doesn't mean the early morning Arati. Literally, it means auspicious Arati. All the Aratis are auspicious, but that's particularly auspicious, getting off to a good start for the day. So it's actually common practice in Vaishnav literatures, particularly, you know, like from the time around the time of Lord Chaitanya and up till now. It's very common, almost just like the normal thing, that if someone is writing some book, then they will have some verses of Mangala Charana to establish the mood and create that proper atmosphere. There are a number of things, in fact, very specific things, which a Mangala Charana is meant to do. We mentioned that briefly yesterday, that Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, he has given a definition as such in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Where is that? Chaitanya Charitamrita. that page here. Panya Charitamrita Adi Lila, chapter 1, verse 22. So Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami gives a definition. Se mangala charana haya trivida prakara vastu nirdesha ashir vada namaskara. Translation: the mangala charana involves three processes. Now, we have written them on the board there. That's the top thing there. So you should write these down because they are going to appear in your test the end of next week. Vastu Nirdesha is number one. Then second is Ashirvad. And third is Namaskar. And what they mean is Vastu Nirdesha. Vastu means the substance. Substance, nirdesh, establishing what is the substance, defining what is the message, in other words, what is the subject matter, what is the objective, defining what the book is all about. Vastu nirdesha. So that is one part, one of the three parts of a Mangala Charana. Then second part is Ashirvad. Ashirvad means offering benedictions. Can you read my writing on the board? Hopefully. Sorry if it's a bit rough. Ashirvad means blessings. Blessings. Benedictions like that. And, you know, that may take different forms, in fact. And as we read through these eight verses, then there is particularly one verse which you'll see that in the very brief notes which we have given, that it says that this is a verse, Mangala Charana verse, which is of this type, Ashirvad type. But when you look at the verse, you'll wonder, you know, what is this? Offering benedictions in that particular case? Anyway, when we get there, I think it'll be quite obvious that this is a rather unusual case. So it means blessings. And it's not just limited to, you know, normally blessings in this context are offered to the readers. Like you may have read in Chaitanya Charitamrita, that, and in the Bhagavatam, it's there also in a number of places. In Chaitanya Bhagavat, if you've read that, you find verses saying that anyone who reads this whole chapter, reads this whole narration about whatever particular subject it is, will achieve love of God, or, you know, there's all sorts of benedictions, really. Particularly, well, in Chaitanya Charitamrita, they're mainly of that nature. But in Srimad Bhagavatam, for example, if you look at the end of the narration about Maharaj Prithu, there are blessings like you'll always be able to, if you've read this whole narration nicely, you can always defeat your enemies and various things like that. So blessings. Anyway, Ashirvad, let us just say that Ashirvad, it refers to blessings and benedictions being offered. It may be in different ways, and we'll see as we go through some examples. That's possible. There are other possibilities too. As we go through, we'll see. Yeah. That sort of thing would come more under, a little bit more under the third type, namaskar, which means offering obeisances, very well, and offering prayers like this, namaskar. is more along those lines. Offering obeisances and offering prayers. So those are the three standard parts of any Mangalacharana. And, you know, for example, Chaitanya Charitamrita, that's a very, very important book of ours. It also begins with a Mangalacharana, so you can have a look through that if you want, and you'll see these different...